I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 103, and it's a continuation of our overview of Lee Harvey Oswald as told by the Warren Commission. It's a wander through his life, and as I keep saying, a wander seen through the lens of the Warren Commission, the Warren Commission narrative. Keep that in mind as you listen to this overview episode. Much of what you'll hear is truly fact. And much of what you'll hear has been included because of its reinforcement of the Warren Commission narrative. Again, that doesn't make it wrong, but what they tell us is geared to one purpose. And all of us just have to balance that out as jurors. We'll get a chance to hear more from others, but regardless, much of what you will hear today is powerful and important as a juror to hear. So let's get going on today's episode. Without further ado, let's listen to episode 103 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. We'll begin today's episode with Oswald's return to New Orleans from New York and his joining the Marine Corps. As you recall, we ended episode 102 with Oswald joining the Marines in October of 1956, but let's rewind the tape just a little bit. After his return to New Orleans from New York, Oswald went back to school, but you see, he was teased at school because of the northern accent which he had acquired while he was in New York. The antagonism he encountered would lead him to a place where he just concluded that school had nothing to offer him. His mother exercised little control over him and thought he could decide for himself whether to continue going to school. Neighbors and others who knew him at that time recall an introverted boy who read a great deal. He took walks and he visited museums and he sometimes rode a rented bicycle in the park on Saturday mornings. Mrs. Murat, his aunt, believes that he talked at length with a girl on the telephone, but no one remembers that he had any dates. A friend, Edward Vogel, testified that he was more bashful about girls than anything else. Several witnesses testified that Lee Oswald was not aggressive. He was, however, involved in some fights. Once a group of white boys beat him up for sitting in the Negro section of a bus, which he apparently did simply out of ignorance. Another time, he fought with two brothers who claimed that he had picked on the younger of them. 3 years Oswald's junior. 2 days later, some big guy, probably from a high school, he looked like a tremendous football player, accosted Oswald on the way home from school and punched him in the mouth, making his lip bleed and loosening a tooth. Vogel took Oswald back to the school to attend to his wounds, and there they formed a mild relationship, which stemmed from that incident. Vogel also recalled that Oswald once outlined a plan to cut the glass in the window of a store on Rampart Street and steal a pistol. But he was not sure then that Oswald meant to carry out the plan, and in fact, they never did do that. Vogel said that Oswald wouldn't start any fights, but if you wanted to start one with him, he was going to make sure that he ended it. Or you were going to really have one because he wasn't going to take anything from anybody. In a space for the names of close friends on the ninth grade personal history record, Oswald first wrote Edward Vogel, an obvious misspelling of Vogel's name, and Arthur Hebert, most likely Arthur Hebert, a classmate that said he did not know Oswald well. Oswald erased those names, however, and indicated that he had no close friends. It has been suggested that this misspelling of names, apparently on a phonetic basis, was caused by a reading-spelling disability from which Oswald appeared to suffer. Other evidence of the existence of such a disability is provided by the many other misspellings that appear in Oswald's writings, portions of which are contained in the commission exhibits. Sometime during this period and under circumstances to be discussed more fully in the Warren Commission findings, Oswald started to read communist literature, which he obtained from the public library. One of his fellow employees, Palmer McBride, stated that Oswald said he would like to kill President Eisenhower because he was exploiting the working class. Oswald praised Khrushchev and suggested that he and McBride join the Communist Party to take advantage of their social functions. Oswald also became interested in the New Orleans Amateur Astronomy Association, an organization of high school students. The association's then president, William E. Wolfe, testified that he remembered an occasion when Oswald started expounding the communist doctrine and saying that he was highly interested in communism, that communism was the only way of life for the worker, etc., and then came out with a statement that he was looking for a communist cell in town to join, but that he couldn't find any. To Wolfe, Oswald appeared to be a little dismayed at this, and he said that he couldn't find any cells that would show any interest in him as a communist. And subsequently, after this conversation, Wolfe's father came in, and when he heard they were kind of arguing back and forth about the situation, his father, recognizing that Lee was loud-mouthed, boisterous, then just asked Lee to leave the house and politely put him out of the house. And that is the last that Wolfe saw or spoke with Oswald. Despite this apparent interest in communism, Oswald tried to join the Marines when he was 16 years old. This was 1 year before his actual enlistment and just a little over 2.5 years after he left New York. He wrote a note in his mother's name to school authorities in New Orleans saying that he was leaving school because he and his mother were moving to San Diego. In fact, he had quit school in an attempt to obtain his mother's assistance to join the Marines. While he apparently was able to induce his mother to make a false statement about his age, he was nevertheless unable to convince the proper authorities that he was really 17 years old. There is evidence that Oswald was greatly influenced in his decision to join the Marines by the fact that his brother Robert had done so approximately 3 years before. Robert Oswald had given his Marine Corps manual to his brother Lee, who studied it during the year following his unsuccessful attempt to enlist, until he knew it by heart. According to Marguerite Oswald, Lee lived for the time that he would become 17 years old to join the Marines. That whole year. In John Pick's view, Oswald was motivated to join the Marines in large part by a desire to get from out and under the yoke of oppression from my mother. Oswald's inability or lack of desire to enter into meaningful relationships with other people continued during this period in New Orleans. That is the period between 1954 and 1956. It probably contributed greatly to the general dissatisfaction which he exhibited with his environment, a dissatisfaction which seemed to find expression at this particular point in his intense desire to join the Marines and get away from his surroundings and his mother. His study of communist literature, which might appear to be inconsistent with his desire to join the Marines, could have been another manifestation of Oswald's rejection of his environment. His difficulty in relating to other people and his general dissatisfaction with the world around him continued while he was in the Marine Corps. Carrie Thornley, a Marine associate, who shortly after Oswald's defection wrote an as-yet-unpublished novel based in considerable part on Oswald's life, testified that definitely the Marine Corps was not what Oswald had expected, at least not what he expected when he joined. He said that Oswald seemed to guard against developing real close relationships. Daniel Powers, another Marine who was stationed with Oswald for part of his Marine career, testified that Oswald seemed always to be striving for a relationship, but whenever he did, his general personality would alienate the group against him. Other Marines also testified that Oswald had few friends and kept very much to himself. While there is nothing in Oswald's military records to indicate that he was mentally unstable or otherwise psychologically unfit for duty in the Marine Corps, he did not adjust well to conditions which he found in that service. He did not rise above the rank of private first class, even though he had passed a qualifying examination for the rank of corporal. His Marine career was not helped by his attitude that he was a man of great ability and intelligence, and that many of his superiors in the Marine Corps were not sufficiently competent to give him orders. While Oswald did not seem to object to authority in the abstract, he did think that he should be the one to exercise it. John E. Donovan, one of his former officers, testified that Oswald thought that authority, particularly the Marine Corps, ought to be able to recognize talent such as his own, without a given magic college degree, and put them in positions of prominence. Oswald manifested this feeling about authority by baiting his officers. He led them into discussions of foreign affairs about which they often knew less than he did, since he had apparently devoted considerable time to a study of such matters. When the officers were unable to discuss foreign affairs satisfactorily with him, Oswald regarded them as unfit to exercise command over him. Nelson Delgado, one of Oswald's fellow Marines, testified that Oswald tried to cut up anybody that was high-ranking in those arguments and make himself come out top dog. Oswald probably engaged his superiors in arguments on a subject that he had studied in an attempt to attract attention to himself and to support his exaggerated idea of his own abilities. Thornley also testified that he thought that Oswald's extreme personal sloppiness in the Marine Corps fitted into a general personality pattern of his, to do whatever was not wanted of him, a recalcitrant trend in his personality. He would go on to say that Oswald seemed to be a person who would go out of his way to get into trouble, and then use the, quote, special treatment he received as an example of the way in which he was being picked on, and as a means of getting or attempting to get sympathy. In Thornley's view, Oswald labored under a persecution complex, which he strove to maintain, and felt the Marine Corps kept a pretty close watch on him because of his subversive activities. Thornley added, "I think it was kind of necessary to him to believe that he was being picked on. It wasn't anything extreme. I wouldn't go as far as to call him a paranoid, but a definite tendency there was in that direction, I think." Powers considered Oswald to be meek and easily led, an individual that you would brainwash and quite easy. But I think once he believed in something, he stood in his beliefs. Powers also testified that Oswald was reserved and seemed to be somewhat the frail little puppy in the litter. He had the nickname Ozzie Rabbit. Oswald read a good deal, said Powers, but he would never be reading any of the shoot-'em-up westerns or anything like that. Normally, it would be a good type of literature, and the one that I recall was Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman. According to Powers, Oswald said, all the Marine Corps did was to teach you to kill, and after you got out of the Marines, you might be a good gangster. Powers believed that when Oswald arrived in Japan, he acquired a girlfriend, finally attaining a male status or image in his own eyes. That apparently caused Oswald to become more self-confident, aggressive, and even somewhat pugnacious. Although Powers wouldn't say that this guy is a troublemaker, Powers said now he was Oswald the man rather than Oswald the rabbit. Oswald once told Powers that he didn't care if he returned to the United States at all. While in Japan, Oswald's newfound apparent self-confidence and pugnaciousness led to an incident in which he spilled a drink on one of his sergeants and abusively challenged him to a fight. At the court-martial hearing which followed, Oswald admitted that he had been rather drunk when the incident occurred. He testified that he had felt the sergeant had a grudge against him and that he had unsuccessfully sought a transfer from the sergeant's unit. He said that he had simply wanted to discuss the question with the sergeant and the drink had been spilled accidentally. The hearing officer agreed with the latter claim, but found Oswald guilty of wrongfully using provoking words and sentenced him to 28 days, canceling the suspension of a 20-day sentence that Oswald had received in an earlier court-martial for possessing an unauthorized pistol with which he had accidentally shot himself. At his own request, Oswald was transferred from active duty to the Marine Corps Reserve under honorable conditions in September of 1959, just 3 months prior to his regularly scheduled separation date, ostensibly to care for his mother, who had been injured in an accident at her work. He was undesirably discharged from the Marine Corps Reserve to which he had been assigned on inactive status following his transfer from active duty after it was learned that he had defected to the Soviet Union. In an attempt to have this discharge reversed, Oswald wrote to then-Secretary of the Navy, John Connally, and he did so on January 30, 1962, stating that he would employ all means to right this gross mistake or injustice. Governor Connally had just resigned to run for governor of Texas, so he advised Oswald that he had forwarded the letter to his successor. It is thus clear that Oswald knew that Governor Connally was never directly concerned with his discharge, and he must have known that President Kennedy had had nothing to do with it as well. In that connection, it does not appear that Oswald ever expressed any dissatisfaction of any kind with either the president or Governor Connally. Marina Oswald testified that she had never heard anything bad about Kennedy from Lee, and he never had anything against him. Mrs. Oswald said that her husband did not say anything about Governor Connally after his return to the United States. Marina testified and said, "But while we were in Russia, he spoke well of him." Lee actually said that when he would return to the United States, he would vote for him, that is, vote for John Connally for governor. Oswald must have already learned that the governor could not help him with his discharge because he was no longer Secretary of the Navy at the time he had made that remark. Even though Oswald apparently did not express any hostility against the president or Governor Connally, he continued to be concerned about his undesirable discharge. It is clear that he thought he had been unjustly treated. Probably his complaint was due to the fact that his discharge was not related to anything he had done while on active duty, and also because he had not received any notice of the original discharge proceedings, since his whereabouts were not known. He continued his efforts to reverse the discharge by petitioning the Navy Discharge Review Board, which finally declined to modify the discharge and so advised him in a letter dated July 1963. Governor Connally's connection with the discharge, although indirect, caused the commission to consider whether he might have been Oswald's real target. In that connection, it should be noted that Marina Oswald testified on September 6, 1964, that she thought her husband was shooting at Connally rather than President Kennedy. In support of her conclusion, Mrs. Oswald noted that her husband's undesirable discharge and that she could not think of any reason why Oswald would want to kill President Kennedy. It should be noted, however, that at the time Oswald fired the shots at the presidential limousine, the governor occupied the seat in front of the president, and it would have been almost impossible for Oswald to have hit the governor without hitting the president first. Oswald could have shot the governor as the car approached the depository or as it was making the turn onto Elm Street once it had started down Elm Street toward the Triple Underpass. However, the president almost completely blocked Oswald's view of the governor prior to the time the first shot struck the president. Okay, let me pause there. You have to put this part of the Warren Commission testimony in context. This was printed well before anyone did a reenactment and pointed a camera or a gun scope lens down towards street level from the sixth floor of the depository. At least not anyone at that point outside of the government. And clearly, this statement is problematic. There was a bullet path from the window to the governor without going through the president. But again, compared to shooting the president, it was probably a more complicated trajectory even than that. The commission goes on to say that, furthermore, Oswald would have had other and more favorable opportunities to strike at the governor than on this occasion when, as a member of the president's party, he had more protection than usual. It would appear, therefore, that to the extent Oswald's undesirable discharge affected his motivation, it was more in terms of a general hostility against the government and its representatives rather than a grudge against any particular person. Okay, this conclusion by the commission is probably correct, although the narrative here is clearly aimed at keeping Oswald's motive aimed at one thing, shooting the president. Now, let's turn to Oswald's interest in Marxism as the story is told through the commission's lens. Oswald started to read communist literature after he and his mother left New York and moved back to New Orleans. He told Aileen Mosby, a reporter who interviewed him after he arrived in Moscow, "I'm a Marxist. I became interested about the age of 15 from an ideological viewpoint. I remember an old lady handed me a pamphlet about saving the Rosenbergs." Okay, and for those who don't recognize the Rosenbergs, this was a big spy case in the 50s where two Russians were convicted and sentenced to death in America after passing nuclear secrets to Russia. Oswald would go on to tell the reporter more details. He would say, "I looked at that paper and I still remember it for some reason. I don't know why." Oswald studied Marxism after he joined the Marines, and his sympathies in that direction and for the Soviet Union appear to have been widely known, at least in the unit to which he was assigned after his return from the Far East. His interest in Russia led some of his associates to call him Comrade or Oswaldskovich. He always wanted to play the red pieces in chess because, as he said in an apparently humorous context, he preferred the Red Army. He studied the Russian language, he read a Russian language newspaper, and seemed interested in what was going on in the Soviet Union. Thornley, who thought Oswald had an irrevocable conviction that his Marxist beliefs were correct, testified as follows. "I think you could sit down and argue with him for a number of years, and I don't think you could have changed his mind on that unless you knew why he believed in it in the first place." "I certainly don't. I don't think with any kind of formal argument you could have shaken that conviction. And that is why I say irrevocable. It was just never getting back to looking at things from any other way once he had become a Marxist, whenever that was." Thornley also testified about an incident which grew out of a combination of Oswald's known Marxist sympathies and George Orwell's book, 1984, one of Oswald's favorite books which Thornley read at Oswald's suggestion. Shortly after Thornley finished reading that book, the Marine unit to which both men were assigned was required to take part in a Saturday morning parade in honor of some retiring non-commissioned officers, an event which they both approached with little enthusiasm. While waiting for the parade to start, they talked briefly about the book, 1984, even though Oswald seemed to be lost in his own thoughts. After a brief period of silence, Oswald remarked on the stupidity of the parade and how angry it made him, to which Thornley replied, "Well, comes the revolution, you will change all that." At which time, Oswald looked at Thornley, somewhat like a betrayed Caesar, and screamed, "Not you too, Thornley." And Thornley would recall that Oswald's voice cracked as he said this. He was definitely disturbed at what I had said, and I didn't really think I had said that much. I never said anything to him again, and he never said anything to me again. Thornley said that he had made his remark only in the context of 1984 and had not intended any criticism of Oswald's political views, which is the way in which Thornley thought Oswald took his remarks. Lieutenant Donovan testified that Oswald thought that there were many grave injustices concerning the affairs in the international situation, He recalled that Oswald had a specific interest in Latin America, particularly Cuba, and expressed opposition to the Batista regime and sympathy for Castro, an attitude which Donovan said was not unpopular at that time. Donovan testified that he never heard Oswald express a desire personally to take part in the elimination of injustices anywhere in the world, and that he never heard him in any way, shape, or form confess that he was a communist, or that he ever thought about being a communist. Delgado testified that Oswald was a complete believer that our way of government was not quite right, and believed that our government did not have too much to offer, but was not in favor of the communist way of life either. Delgado and Oswald talked more about Cuba than Russia, and sometimes imagined themselves as leaders in the Cuban army or government who might lead an expedition to some of these other islands and free them too. Thornley also believed that Oswald's Marxist beliefs led to an extraordinary view of history, under which Oswald looked upon the eyes of future people as some kind of tribunal, and he wanted to be on the winning side so that 10,000 years from now, people would look in the history books and say, well, this man was ahead of his time. The eyes of the future became the eyes of God. Oswald was concerned with his image and history, and I do think that is why he chose the particular method of defecting that he chose, and did it in the way that he did. It got him in the newspapers. It did broadcast his name out. Thornley thought that Oswald not only wanted a place in history, but also wanted to live comfortably in the present. He testified that if Oswald could not have that degree of physical comfort that he expected or sought, I think he would then throw himself entirely on the other thing he also wanted, which was the image in history. I think he wanted both if he could have them. If he didn't, he wanted to die with the knowledge that, or with the idea that, he was somebody. Oswald's interest in Marxism led some people to avoid him, even though, as his wife suggested, that interest may have been motivated by a desire to gain attention. He used his Marxist and associated activities as excuses for his difficulties in getting along in the world, which were usually caused by entirely different factors. His use of those excuses to present himself to the world as a person who was being unfairly treated is shown most clearly by his employment relations after his return from the Soviet Union. Of course, he made his real problems worse to the extent that his use of those excuses prevented him from discovering the real reasons for and attempting to overcome his difficulties. Of greater importance, Oswald's commitment to Marxism contributed to the decisions which led him to defect to the Soviet Union in 1959, and later to engage in activities on behalf of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in the summer of 1963 and to attempt to go to Cuba late in September of that year. Now, let's pause for a second and turn to the Commission's narrative about Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union. After Oswald left the Marine Corps in September of 1959, ostensibly to care for his mother, he almost immediately left for the Soviet Union, where he attempted to renounce his citizenship. At the age of 19, Oswald thus committed an act which was the most striking indication he had yet given of his willingness to act on his beliefs in quite extraordinary ways. While his defection resulted in part from Oswald's commitment to Marxism, it appears that personal and psychological factors were also involved. On August 17, 1963, Oswald told Mr. William Stuckey, who had arranged a radio debate on Oswald's activities on behalf of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, that while he had begun to read Marx and Engels at the age of 15, the conclusive thing that made him decide that Marxism was the answer was his service in Japan. He said living conditions over there convinced him something was wrong with the system and that possibly Marxism was the answer. He said it was in Japan that he made up his mind to go to Russia and see for himself how a revolutionary society operates, a Marxist society. On the other hand, at least one person who knew Oswald after his return thought that his defection had a more personal and psychological basis. The validity of the latter observation is borne out by some of the things Oswald wrote in connection with his defection, indicating that his motivation was at least, in part, a personal one. On November 26, 1959, shortly after he arrived in the Soviet Union, and probably before Soviet authorities had given him permission to stay indefinitely, he wrote to his brother Robert that the Soviet Union was a country which I have always considered to be my own, and that he went there only to find freedom. I could never have been personally happy in the U.S., he wrote in another letter. And he also wrote that he would never return to the United States, which is a country I hate. His idea that he was to find freedom in the Soviet Union was to be rudely shattered. Whatever Oswald's reasons were for going to the Soviet Union, there can be little doubt that his desire to go was quite strong. In addition to studying the Russian language, while he was in the Marines, Oswald had managed to save enough money to cover the expenses of the forthcoming trip. While there is no proof that he saved $1,500, as he claimed, it would have taken considerable discipline to save whatever amount was required to finance his defection out of the salary of a low-ranking enlisted man. I'll stop there. On a side note, we will explore this deeper in a coming episode. As the commission acknowledged this but did not pursue any possibility that someone else potentially funded this defection. All right, back to the report. The extent of Oswald's desire to go to the Soviet Union and of his initial commitment to that country can best be understood, however, in the context of his concomitant hatred of the United States, which was most clearly expressed in his November 26, 1959 letter to his brother Robert, addressing himself to the question of why I and my fellow workers and communists would like to see the present capitalist government of the United States overthrown. Oswald stated that the government supported an economic system which exploits all its workers and under which art, culture, and the spirit of man are subjected to commercial enterprising. And religion and education are used as a tool to suppress what would otherwise be a population questioning their government's unfair economic system and plans for war. Oswald complained in his letter about segregation, unemployment, automation, and the use of military forces to suppress other populations. Ask me, and I will tell you I fight for communism. I will not say your grandchildren will live under communism. Look for yourself at history. Look at a world map. America is a dicing country. I do not wish to be a part of it, nor do I ever again wish to be used as a tool in its military aggressions. This should answer your question and also give you a glimpse of my way of thinking. So you speak of advantages? Do you think that is why I am here? For personal, material advantages? Happiness is not based on oneself. It does not consist of a small home, of taking and getting. Happiness is taking part in the struggle, where there is no borderline between one's own personal world and the world in general. I never believed I would find more material advantages at this stage of development in the Soviet Union than I might have had in the U.S. Oswald went on to write in his letter to Robert, "I have been a pro-communist for years, and yet I have never met a communist. Instead, I kept silent and observed, and what I observed plus my Marxist leaning brought me here to the Soviet Union. I have always considered this country to be my own." Responding to Robert's statement that he had not renounced him, Oswald told his brother, "On what terms I want this arrangement." He advised Robert that, number one, in the event of war, I would kill any American who put a uniform on in defense of the American government. Any American. Number two, that in my own mind, I have no attachments of any kind in the U.S. Number three, that I want to, and I shall, live a normal, happy, and peaceful life here in the Soviet Union for the rest of my life. And number four, that my mother and you are, in spite of what the newspaper said, not objects of affection, but only examples of workers in the U.S. Despite this commitment to the Soviet Union, Oswald met disappointments there, just as he had in the past. At the outset, the Soviets told him that he could not remain. It seems that Oswald immediately attempted suicide, a striking indication of how much he desired to remain in the Soviet Union. It shows how willing he was to act dramatically and decisively when he faced an emotional crisis with few readily available alternatives at hand. He was shocked to find that the Soviet Union did not accept him with open arms. The entry in his self-styled historic diary for October 21, 1959 reports the following. I am shocked. My dreams. I have waited for 2 years to be accepted. My fondest dreams are shattered because of a petty official. I decide to end it, soak fist in cold water to numb the pain, then slash my left wrist, then plow the wrist into a bathtub of hot water. Somewhere, a violin plays as I watch my life whirl away. I think to myself, how easy to die, and a sweet death to violins. Oswald was discovered in time to thwart his attempt at suicide. He was taken to a hospital in Moscow, where he was kept until October 28, 1959. Still intent upon staying in the Soviet Union, Oswald went on October 31st to the American Embassy to renounce his U.S. citizenship. Mr. Richard E. Snyder, then the second secretary and senior consular official at the embassy, testified that Oswald was extremely sure of himself and seemed to know what his mission was. He took charge, in a sense, of the conversation right from the beginning. He presented the following signed note. I, Lee Harvey Oswald, do hereby request that my present citizenship in the United States of America be revoked. I have entered the Soviet Union for the express purpose of applying for citizenship in the Soviet Union through the means of naturalization. My request for citizenship is now pending before the Supreme Soviet of the USSR. I take these steps for political reasons. My request for the revoking of my American citizenship is made only after the longest and most serious considerations. I affirm that my allegiance is to the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. As his principal reason for renouncing his citizenship, Oswald stated, I am a Marxist. He also alluded to hardships endured by his mother as a worker, referring to them as experiences that he did not intend to have himself, even though he stated that he had never held a civilian job. He said that his Marine service in Okinawa and elsewhere had given him a chance to observe American imperialism. But he also displayed some sensitivity at not having reached a higher rank in the Marine Corps. He stated that he had volunteered to give Soviet officials any information that he had concerning Marine Corps operations and intimated that he might know something of special interest. Oswald's historic diary describes the event in part as follows. I leave embassy. Elated at this showdown, returning to my hotel, I feel now my energies are not spent in vain. I'm sure Russians will accept me after this sign of my faith in them. The Soviet authorities finally permitted Oswald to remain in their country. No evidence has been found that they used him for any particular propaganda or other political or informational purposes. They sent him to Minsk to work in a radio and television factory as a metal worker. The Soviet authorities denied Oswald permission to attend a university in Moscow, but they gave him a monthly allowance of 700 rubles a month, in addition to his factory salary of approximately equal amount, and he received considerably better living quarters than those accorded to Soviet citizens of equal age and station. The subsidy, apparently similar to those sometimes given to foreigners allowed to remain in the Soviet Union, together with his salary, gave Oswald an income which he said approximated that of the director of the factory in which he worked. Even though he received more money and better living quarters than other Russians doing similar work, he envied his wife's uncle, a colonel in the MVD, because of the larger apartment in which he lived. Reminiscent of his attitude toward his superiors in the Marine Corps, Oswald apparently resented the exercise of authority over him and the better treatment afforded to Communist Party officials. After he returned to the United States, he took the position that the Communist Party officials in the Soviet Union were opportunists who were betraying their positions for personal gain. He is reported to have expressed the conclusion that they had fat, stinking politicians over there, just like we have over here. Oswald apparently continued to have personal difficulties while he was in Minsk. Although Marina Oswald told the commission that her husband had good personal relationships in the Soviet Union, Catherine Ford, one of the members of the Russian community in Dallas with which the Oswalds became acquainted upon their arrival back in the United States, stated that Mrs. Oswald told her everybody in Russia hated him. Jeannie de Morenschild, another member of that group, said that Oswald told her that he had returned because I didn't find what I was looking for. George de Morenschild thought that Oswald must have become disgusted with life in the Soviet Union as the novelty of the presence of an American wore off and he began to be less the center of attention. The best description of Oswald's state of mind, however, is set forth in his own historic diary. Under the entry for May 1, 1960, he noted that one of his acquaintances relates many things I do not know about the USSR. I begin to feel uneasy inside. It's true. Under the entry for August-September of that year, Oswald would continue to write, "As my Russian improves, I become increasingly conscious of just what sort of a society I live in. Mass gymnastics, compulsory after-work meetings, usually political information meetings, compulsory attendance at lectures, and the sending of the entire shop collective, except me, to pick potatoes on a Sunday at a state collective farm, a patriot duty to bring in the harvest. The opinions of the workers unvoiced are that it is a great pain in the neck. They don't seem to be especially enthusiastic about any of the collective duties. A natural feeling. I am increasingly aware of the presence in all things of Lebezian, who is the shop party secretary, fat, 40-ish, and jovial on the outside. He is a no-nonsense party regular." Finally, the entry that Oswald made on January 4th through the 31st of 1961, "I am starting to reconsider my desire about staying. The work is drab. The money I get has nowhere to be spent. No nightclubs or bowling alleys, no places of recreation except the trade union dances. I have had enough." Shortly thereafter, less than 18 months after his defection, about 6 weeks before he met Marina Prusakova, Oswald opened negotiations with the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, looking toward his return to the United States. Thank you for listening to episode 103 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.